It is my pleasure to introduce Wes Martell to the symposium. I've known Wes for about the last 20 years, that I have a course on natural resource management on Western reservations, and I take the students up to the reservation for a week, and in that week time, they meet tribal leaders, managers, and then they go out in the field and actually see what's going on in the field and ask questions of the managers about how they do things and so forth. And in 1994 was the first year I did that, and Wes, unbeknownst to him, I was bringing up 13 students for a week, and he introduced himself and talked to my class about water rights and issues on the reservation. And the students were so enthralled with what he was doing, what he was talking about. We spent two full days with him. And so he was the guinea pig, actually, for these students, because that was the first time that had ever happened. So again, I've known Wes for quite a long time. Wes was born on the Wind River Reservation and grew up there and went to school on the reservation. Graduated from high school and decided to go to college and went to University of Colorado at Denver back in 1977, and then went back to the reservation for a summer job and took on an internship and became the editor of the Wind River News newspaper. And that paper was started at that point in time, and it's still going today. And so Wes, we could look at him as kind of the William Randolph Hearst of newspapers on the reservation. As a reporter for the newspaper and so forth, he started to look at what was going on the reservation and started to examine and question some of the decisions were being made in terms of the government policies and social issues on the reservation, and got very involved in what was going on and started to look at the background of these issues and needs. And somehow got roped into running for tribal council in 1979, and unbeknownst to him, he got elected. And so then he had to start really doing something about what he's looking at. And since then, he's been on the tribal council multiple times, and overall, he's served the last almost 19 years on tribal council. through that, through a multitude of projects that he's worked on, he's looked at water rights and taxation. He's the vice president of the Wind River Association, a consulting firm on the reservation. In 1985, he started to, again, look at issues on the reservation, and they started to develop the first water code on the reservation back in 1985. He was part of the Environmental Quality Commission since 1990. and one of the major things that, when they were examining issues, water issues, environmental issues, they started to look at issues with oil and gas on the reservation and the national companies that were extracting oil and gas and not paying their fair share, and also not recording the amount of oil and gas that they were extracting so that they didn't have to pay royalties and revenues on those. So that was a major issue in those period. Wes is a veteran of the military, and currently he is on the National Tribal Caucus for Environmental Protection. Back when I knew Wes in 1994 and so forth, our hair was about the same color. And for some reason, mine got whiter, and his stayed about the same. But his is going to change, because right now he's raising his two grandchildren, twin sons, twin grandsons. And so his hair will start looking like mine, especially when they get their driver's license. And so be prepared for the worst. And so with that, I'd like to introduce Wes Martell.
Thank you. Thank you for that great introduction. And, you know, I'm really kind of honored to be here with the great array of speakers that we've had and my brothers and sisters that have gone before me. And I've really provided us good information and good insights. And I told LaDonna, she reinvigorated me again this morning with her talk and her discussions. And I also want to thank Crawford. I don't know if he's here for starting off with a prayer this morning. Ho-ho, thank you for that. Good way to start us off. And also American Indian Studies Program for getting this organization together. And, you know, we got a little bit of insight as to how they were able to pull this together and the opportunities they have to do some additional things in the future. And I think it's really a good omen for Wyoming and for the university. And it speaks well for Judy and all the students that were here. Because when you come here as a student, you make an impact somehow. Whether they just see you walking down the street or in the classroom, but that's a good way to, you know, demonstrate the presence of our people. And it's good for all of our other surrounding communities, because we've got a lot of people that come to school here from Montana, the Sioux tribes, and, you know, a lot of other reservations here. So really, really good to see that. You know, in the introduction, I talked about, and then I want to talk about water, energy, and land, because I think that's the three most important issues that we have to contend with. And, you know, Walter talked about some of the cultural sovereignty and political sovereignty that we deal with. And, you know, that's what I always tell people, is our sovereignty and our spirituality is connected. And so we have to make sure that we have advisors and leaders and others that understand how that connection is. And water's the most important of all. And it's connected to everything we're ever going to do. And at Wind River, we kind of learned things that we learned about water the hard way. Wyoming took us into court in 1977, several years later. And in fact, today, we're still fighting certain aspects of that case since 1977, right? 36 years later, we're still fighting certain elements of that case. But when we first got dragged into court, you know, it was like, We were caught unaware. We weren't prepared for it. And now that we've seen what's going on, and I'm going to make some points in my presentation, it's really critical that tribes start laying a foundation for claiming their water rights. And the way you do that is by developing tribal water codes, a tribal water law. And we need tribal water laws because Western water law cannot protect our water rights the way we need it protected as Indian people. We have a special spiritual and traditional attachments to the water. Our elders call it the water of life. I remember my grandpa when we'd be out fixing fence in the younger days and had those canvas water bags hanging off the mirror of the truck, you know, back in the old days. And, you know, every time we'd go get a drink and he'd pour a little bit out. And I never thought about it too much. And finally one day I said, "Hey, Grandpa, how come you always spill water out on the ground?" And he said, "Well, I always give Mother Earth a drink before I take them." And then those old guys, when they drink water, they bless themselves. Take a drink of water, bless themselves with that. So that water is the most important resource we've got. And at Wyoming, here in Wyoming, we got taken into court in 1977. And we finally ended up losing 2/3 of our water, our surface water, in the courts. And the Supreme Court says we do not have a reserved right to groundwater. How nuts is that, right? Just some of the stuff Bunky was talking about. Walter, I'm sorry, that you know, he's you know, the way the Supreme Court decides some of these cases. And he mentioned, you know, this Supreme Court we have now, in the view of most tribal leaders, they're kind of borderline criminals themselves. You know, it's like ignored all precedences of federal Indian law and all treaty law and everything else. So, You know, they really have hurt Indian tribes here. So let me go into my presentation here, and I think I'm uptown here with, The most important area I think we really got to concentrate on is upholding the Winner's Doctrine. Fort Belknap, 1908, where the Supreme Court said, federally recognized tribes and reservations have a federal Indian reserve water right to serve the purposes of those lands being permanent homelands. And where this and all other federal lands have a reserved water right, but we've got to make the distinction. This is Indian, federal Indian reserved water rights. Right now, the 567 federally recognized tribes in the country, there's probably only 30 that have done anything with their water rights. And most of them have signed these negotiated settlement agreements, right? Wind River, we litigated. Our case went all the way up to the United States Supreme Court. So that means that there's still, and only about 30 have done anything, there's still about 537 federally recognized tribes out there that haven't done anything with their water. And so, you know, again, tribes must adopt a tribal water law and designate a tribal water engineer. Every state in the West has, you know, their water laws, and every state has a state water engineer. And that's how important water is. Very important part of our resource. It's a sacred gift from the Creator, right? As we all know. The Bighorn adjudication awarded Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapahoes 500,717 acre-feet of water with an 1868 priority date. And, you know, that's real critical, because in Western water law, right, prior appropriation, first in time, first in right. So with an 1868 priority date, which is the date of our last treaty, that's a pretty good priority date. Other tribes have a little bit earlier priority date. I know we used to do a lot of work with the Pueblos. They say our priority date's immemorial. We've been here since the beginning of time. We can't put a date on our priority date. So I like that approach. Wind River, we're one of the few reservations now that's non-IRA. We don't have no constitution. So when we adopted our tribal water law back in the early mid-80s, that was the first thing the state attacked us on. Ah, them Indians don't have a constitution. Them Indians don't have no separation of powers. Them Indians shouldn't be allowed to have any laws. So when we thought about it, and even before that, when we adopted our first severance tax, we established a tribal court. A lot of reservations still have the Court of Indian Offenses, right? And I think Oklahoma, a lot of places have that. It's kind of like a BIA court, a federal government court, right? So we switched our court to we created the tribal court, and then we designated the Joint Business Council as our executive branch. And then when we adopted our tribal water code, we took it to each general council. And in our tribal water code, we basically made the Wind River Water Resources Control Board one of the legislative arms of our government. And so they were delegated legislative authority by the general council of each tribe to be the primary management and enforcement agency of the water resources of the Wind River Reservation. So they were delegated legislative authority. In the code, they can promulgate regulations, amend the code. They're the board that controls our water resources. So without a constitution, we achieved a separation of power. And in our law and order code, there's a statement in there that says these other entities cannot interfere. And that's wise exercise of tribal sovereignty, right? Creating a separation of powers without a constitution. And that's our right. That's our inherent authority. And that's our way we can carry out our authority. And doing it wisely. You know, when Walter was talking about some of the cases that have gone up, the dark side of some of these cases, you know, there's some cases that probably should not have gone up to the Supreme Court. And there's a few tribes that have got them into relating to water. There was one tribe up in Montana a few years back that some non-Indians were coming down the river and fishing and coming down the river, and the tribe said, "We're closing the river on our reservation. We're not going to allow any more non-Indians to float the river." Well, that case went to the United States Supreme Court, and guess what? That tribe lost the bed of the river. Now, You know, there's other ways to exercise your sovereignty. Rather than saying no non-Indians allowed, we should have said, oh, we love non-Indians on our river, but you're going to pay $1,000 for your permit. And not too many people would have came on the river, right? So, you know, hindsight's 20/20. But that's why I talk about exercising sovereignty wisely as tribal leaders, as tribal attorneys, as tribal advisors. You know, we have to strategize. A lot of times we don't connect nationally as well as we should. But, you know, that's a real important part of exercising your sovereign authority. Especially west of the Mississippi. Now, back east, they have riparian rights, you know, which differs from prior appropriation. But west of the Mississippi, where we have first in time, first in right, prior appropriation, much of these major river basins, the Missouri River Valley Basin, we're in the Missouri River. Wind River Reservation, we're part of the headwaters of the Missouri River Valley Basin. Blackfeet, Fort Peck, we're all part of the headwaters in Missouri. Eventually ends up in the Gulf of Mexico, right? The Northwest, and Wyoming's very unique. We're in three major basins. Wyoming goes into Missouri River, then on the west up by Jackson, Snake River, which goes into the Columbia, and then down by Green River, we have Flaming Gorge Reservoir, which goes into the Colorado River Basin. So Wyoming's very unique. A lot of the water running through these major basins is Indian water, federal Indian reserved water rights. But you look at all across the West, you have these state engineers approving all these permits, approving all these applications for cities and mining companies and developers. And guess what? Most of the tribes haven't had their water rights determined yet. And that's going to be real critical. And I always talk about it. You know, why don't we have a national organization dedicated, Indian Oregon, strictly to water rights? And I've even thought about this and like to get Walter and some of the other people's thoughts on this. Way back, they had the Indian Lands Claim Commission, right, for tribes. And it kind of got all caught up in politics and legalities, and some pretty ugly stuff happened to reservation based on that. But I think somewhere down the road, we're going to have a Federal Indian Water Claims Commission. Because right now, unfortunately, a lot of tribes aren't paying attention to it. But they're paying attention to their casinos and their hotels and all these other things, but they're not paying attention to the thing that makes their casinos and hotels run, right? So I think that's really something that has to be an aspect. And a couple times I mentioned that in NCAI, but didn't make too much headway on it. You know, water's connected to everything, and I think water's going to be the new gold of the future. Right now in the Colorado River Basin, on some of these spot market sales, water's going for $25,000 to $30,000 for 1 acre foot. And part of our plan is to try to get some water situated where we can send it down the Colorado River or some other tribes. And if you've got 100,000 acre feet that you can send down into the Colorado River, $30,000 an acre foot, that's a lot of zeros. And that's going to be, I think, a real important resource that tribes have to consider. And you young students, we need hydrologists, we need engineers, we need environmental engineers, we need those kind of people, right? That's the presence that we need to have. The thing, too, that I think really dissuades a lot of tribal leaders from really moving forward, just naturally, right? When we don't really understand things, we kind of don't really push it. But based on what we learned through all the adjudication at Wind River, we came up with these issues that are very important, major issues. And if everybody understood these, all tribal leaders, I think we could really start moving forward. The number one thing you got to look at is your treaty. At Wind River, when they looked at our treaty, they used it against us. The original treaty said the Eastern Shoshone Reservation is hereby created as an agricultural reservation. So Wyoming focused on that and said, well, the only reason Wind River is supposed to have water is for agriculture. So us Shoshones and Arapahoes, we ain't supposed to be attorneys and down here. We're supposed to be back home farming right now, right, according to the state of Wyoming. But we've looked at a lot of other Orville St. Clair and I used to do a lot of work. We used to do seminars on this, major issues. I'm going to give this to you in 3 minutes. We used to do it in 3 days. But the purpose of the reservation, we've seen some other tribal treaties that's got great language, calculated to advance them in civilization. If that's in your treaty, you're not restricted to being a farmer like us guys, right? Or we've seen others, resume the pursuits of industry. So your treaty is a very important document, and most tribes don't even understand that. Read your treaty. What does it say? Because that's going to determine how your water rights are going to be attacked. And believe me, they will be attacked. Surface groundwater, right at Wind River, we have no reserve right to groundwater. That's nuts. It's one resource, right? It's a unitary resource. Quantification, we got 500,000 acre feet. And a lot of tribal leaders, when I first got on, and I think it was Walter was talking about some of the old guys, and I used to go and listen to them, and I really miss those guys, the Wendell Chino, Roger Jourdain, Norman Hollow, Russell Jim, Joe Dela Cruz, all these old guys, boy, they'd get up in NCAI, and they'd fire you up, man. You want to put on your war paint right now. All those guys are gone that I just mentioned. And the real scary thing for me has been around as long as I have is a lot of these tribal leaders nowadays don't have a good handle on tribal sovereignty. They don't understand these battles we've been fighting in the 70s and the 80s and even before that. I got on in 79, and that's when Oliphant was coming down and the Yakima cases and a lot of these other things that was attacking tribal sovereignty and jurisdiction. Administration, very important part of Western water law, marketing and leasing. Tribes should have the rights to market and lease water if they so desire. Practically irrigable acreage. This is a real critical one. PIA. That's why they focused on PIA at Wind River, because we're supposed to be farming it. We used California's definition criteria for practically irrigable acreage. And then we didn't really have good cultural and traditional testimony in our case. The cultural testimony and traditional testimony that was put into our water case was like a 90-year-old anthropologist from Boulder, Colorado. Where was our elders? But here's what I'm getting at. Practically irrigable acres, they looked at wheat and corn and barley and some of the white man's crops, and some of those are Indian crops too, but using their criteria. As Indian people, we've got a lot of other things out there that we need water for. Our cedar trees, right? Our sage. All those medicines and those roots and plants that we use that are out there. We should have been talking about that in our case. So anybody that's going to fight your water rights, make sure you come up with your own criteria for PIA, right? Don't use California's or anybody else's. Historic lands, we're a lot of mountain country up at Wind River. The Wind River Range on the west, the Owl Creek Range on the north side. So they came up with 104,000 acres of PIA at Wind River. And about 54,000 acres of that was what they called historic acreage. Land that had been farmed, is being farmed or had been farmed at one point in time. And then they talked about historic lands. Lands that have never, ever been farmed, but we can do that in the future. Futures lands. So use it or lose it does not apply to tribes, right? That's a very important concept of Western water law. If you don't use your water, you lose it. And the state engineer can cancel your permit. But for this federal Indian reserved right, we don't have to use it. We can still use it somewhere down the road if we want to start farming it. Transfer of use, another very important term in Western water law. And these are all part of, understanding how you want to craft your code. If somebody went to the state engineer in Cheyenne and said, I want to transfer my agricultural water to recreation, 999 times out of 1,000, you'd probably get denied. Because water's the priority use, right? Agriculture. So transfer of use, very important document. Beneficial use, another important term. Surplus, consumptive use. A lot of these settlements that tribes are signing, For instance, Fort Peck, they got 1 million acre feet awarded. Their consumptive use rate's 50%. So actually, they only got 500,000 acre feet, right? That's all they can use. I've seen a little bit of improvement in the Fort Hall settlement. Their consumptive use rate went up to 60%. But you got to justify 85, 90% consumptive uses. And now that I, like I said, we learned lessons the hard way, before you litigate or negotiate your water rights, you should have a tribal water code in place. And we learned it the hard way. Well, we got drug into court, right? And we weren't even thinking water code back in those days. But the condition of the irrigation project, most BIA irrigation projects in the country are in a sad state of disrepair. And most tribal members can't get the water they're entitled to, even if they want to irrigate their fields. And then, of course, the cultural concerns. Off-reservation authority, I think there has to be some things there. I know Duck Valley out in Nevada, they've got a small reservoir that's built off their reservation that they control. So you have to really look at that. Where do you fit? Where are you, right? We're at the headwaters. Where are you in the system? Are there dams above you, dams below you? What's going on, right? And then Walton writes is, if a non-Indian buys an allotment from a tribal member and he puts that water to beneficial use within a reasonable amount of time, he also gets the 1868 priority date. So that was another case that came up and by the Supreme Court. So that's water. And I really think, like I say, that's the most important resource. And those major issues that I just went through, tribes got to understand those. And I know we've been having some good meetings. Sarah is on our Water Resources Control Board. And, you know, Mr. Chairman, is, you know, we've been able to meet with a water board. And so we're really trying to put together a comprehensive plan. I and Orville St. Clair and Ruin Council, Daryl Brown and Gary Collins, we were kind of assigned the responsibility of coming up with a tribal water code. And I about fell out of my chair, right? I said, man, I'm no attorney. I don't know nothing about codes. And we had Dick Trudell and got a group of people together to come up and help us. And David Getches came up. And most of you know David was one of the original founders of NARF and was very well versed in federal Indian law, federal water rights. He was not only an attorney, he was a state engineer for Colorado. And he's the one that helped us put our code together. And in fact, I use the stuff he tells me to this day. We've talked about the policy making. What kind of policies do you have for your codes? What kind of legal issues do you have to deal with on your codes? What kind of technical issues do you deal with on your codes and administrative? And the Wind River Water Code is about 28 pages. But it talks about our culture, spiritual concern. You get Wyoming's water law, it's about 2,800 pages, right? So we were really able to put everything into a document that's good for us as the Shoshone and Arapaho tribe. And I know our neighbors to the west of us, I happened to look at their water code one day, and all they did was take Shoshone and Arapaho off it and put Shoshone and Bannock at the top, which is great, you know, it's good. The next issue that we've been dealing with at Wind River is energy. And when I first got into council in 1979, we thought about all these oil trucks we used to see coming out of our hills 24 hours a day. And, you know, even I remember my grandma and grandpas and all of us that, you know, were around in those days, they talked, man, there's an awful lot of oil trucks coming out of our hills. And so we finally got a group together. And back in those days, Judge St. Clair was one of our group. And we hooked up with an oil man out of Denver that kind of taught us the industry. Because that was another thing. We didn't know. The only thing I knew about oil back then, you had to put it in your car every once in a while. But we ended up, you know, understanding the industry. And then we started understanding the government documents. And we started understanding the physical layout of the fields. And the important thing we found out is that you got to take those documents, the reporting documents, the royalty document, production documents, APDs, all these documents, and correlate what's actually out there on the lease site. And so we ended up launching an investigation. We covered every lease and every company on the reservation, and every lease and every company on the reservation was stealing from us. And that was 1979. And how that got started, there was a USGS inspector that found a truckload of oil out there, and this driver didn't have his run ticket. And a run ticket is a little piece of legal documentation that says you're legally authorized to haul this oil. And he didn't have a run ticket. So that got reported to the tribes by the BIA in about March of 1979. And, you know, finally in about August, we asked the BIA superintendent, hey, what happened to that? Oh, well, we're still trying to figure out what's going on out there. So you know how it is. We said, well, we can't wait on the BIA. So got a bunch of us together, not a bunch, probably five or six of us that kind of went out there and start looking at all the companies and all the leases. And there was a legal bypass. One of the big tricks that they had, these lease sites, they'll have a waste pit below the tank batteries. And that's supposed to only catch oil if, like, there's a break in the line or the tank or something. It's a waste pit. But what they were doing, they were just dumping oil into those pits. And most of those leased fields had at least three pits. And there's hundreds of barrels of oil in each pit. And you could just see it out there. They're just, those tanker trucks were just coming up, putting their hoses in there, turned on the pump, filled up. And that's where those trucks were coming out of our hills 24 hours a day. Hundreds of them. Hundreds of them. Early on, even before we noticed it, right? The 60s and 70s and then 79 is when we started it. With the help of this oil man, and we found this field out there, we launched that investigation. We met with Dick Cheney when he was our representative. By the way, he was a Democrat at that time, too. Most people don't remember that. But Cheney used to be a Democrat back then. But anyway, that's when Congress created the Federal Oil and Gas Royalty Management Act of 1982. And that act started right from the Sheldon Dome Field on the Windrower Reservation. And I'm going to show you that. So we're pretty proud of that. But again, that's exercising your sovereignty, right? Exercising your rights as tribal people and the resources that we have. How do we protect that and manage it? But anyway, we were getting threats from these oil company guys because those are some of those tough characters. I mean, you know, you're talking millions of dollars. And so we'd be out there inspecting. Boy, we had our rifles with us and, you know, we were making sure that we took care of ourselves. And finally we said, well, we better bust this news. So we contacted the New York Times, the Denver Post, Los Angeles Times, Wall Street Journal, and a few other national newspapers. On October 12th, 1979, we busted the story wide open on a national level. On October 13th, guess what? No more trucks coming out of our hills. So that told us something right there, that for decades people were ripping us off. And so, again, got to stand up for ourselves, right? But anyway, at Wind River, we have several types of leasing agreements. The 1891 statute, and that was renegotiable every 5 years. We had the 1916 Leasing Act, which was renegotiable every 10 years. The royalty rate was 1/6. And then after that, they start, and most tribes now are stuck with these leases. They're held by production, and you never have an opportunity to go back and renegotiate them. You're stuck with that royalty until they drain the reserve. And so that's a real important part of, you know, exercising our sovereignty wisely. And you know, you get 1/8, the company's getting 7/8, no chance to ever renegotiate. So, again, I talked about the investigation, the Federal Oil and Gas Royalty Management Act, and then Congress also adopted the Indian Minerals Development Act, which was an attempt to allow tribes to enter into other agreements besides a lease, right? Operating agreements, joint ventures, partnerships. But guess what? BIA, all this time, they just keep recommending the standard old lease. And then they have enough nerve to slap themselves on the back. Oh, we just signed an IMDA the other day. It's just your same old standard lease, 1/8 royalty held by production. Then in 2005, Congress adopted the Energy Policy Act, and that was amended in 2011. But one of the things in there is it allows tribes to enter these tribal energy resource agreements. And tribes can have started the can start having some of the permitting authority, do some of the environmental work, and I support them. There's a lot of tribes that don't. They're, you know, the old scare tactics. Well, we think the secretary might get out from his trust responsibility. Well, if you really look at it, the secretary's really never upheld his trust responsibility, right? So what are we scared of, you know? But anyway, I think it's a real important part of recognizing and upholding tribal sovereignty, these tribal energy resource agreements. Not one tribe has entered into one yet, but at Wind River, we're gearing up. We hope to be the first tribe. And again, greater oversight and management, which bolsters tribal sovereignty, and then, you know, looks into the taxation, environment, economics. And another part of this is the taxation. And I only got 10 minutes left. Man, I think Bunky cut into about 30 minutes of my time, so I got to get an extension here. But anyway, real quickly, right now, Wyoming and Fremont County collect more taxes off our oil and gas than we do as the tribes. And between them, they get 13.5%, tribal taxes, 8.5%. The way to not have to pay state and county taxes, there's a very simple way to do this. Sign operating agreement. Because there was a Supreme Court decision called Cotton Petroleum, which says a non-Indian company operating on the reservation under a lease agreement can be taxed by the state and county. Because the Supreme Court, again, the dark side of the Supreme Court reasoned that when these tribes sign that lease agreement, they're turning their resource over to that non-Indian company. So that company can be taxed. But under an operating agreement, and this is I'm advocating our council to sign these types of agreements, the operating agreement, that resource stays under 100% ownership of the tribe, and the state and county cannot come in and tax it. And I know, like up at Fort Berthold right now, they're crying around about, well, the state and county's taxing them. Well, keep signing those lease agreements, guys, and they'll keep taxing you. Tribes must create tax commissions, public service commissions. You know, we got to be doing all the stuff that the state is doing. Tribes should adopt every tax that the state has. Every tax that the state of Wyoming has, we should have it at Wind River. Because that way we position ourselves to preempt state and county taxes. Why do we let them collect all the taxes? We're the ones that should be collecting it, right? And then the power to tax versus the power not to tax. See, then we're in a position to also give tax credits. You know, you see the counties and states and cities doing that all the time. They'll give Walmart a big tax credit for to come locate or something. So again, it's a good tool to attract business and industry. But you got to understand the state and county taxing authority. There's also PILT out there, payment in lieu of taxes, and it's a federal formula that Congress pays to the counties for federal lands. And most of our western states are a lot of federal lands, right? Got a lot of BLM, Park Service, Forest Service land. So they pay them payment in lieu of taxes, and it's a formula. And I just read the other day that it's getting cut by the sequester too, so counties are all up in arms about that. But all federal lands are in the PILT formula except reservations. So my solution to the county property tax, put reservations under the PILT formula and give the tribes their tax base back and pay reservation PILT to the counties. So that's my solution. I've got a quick map here of the... Where's my tech guy here? I just want to do a quick overview of this map that we have. This is the county taxing structure, and what I wanted to get at very quickly, you have School District 21, which is basically an Indian district. School District 14, right? Here's the boundaries, right? Here's small district. And then School District 38, see them just right here? Just a little bit of like an arrowhead shape there. Well, then here's School District 25, non-Indian school district. School District 24, non-Indian school district, which is located off the res. This is in Hot Springs County. School District Number 6, which is a non-Indian school district, and School District Number 2, which is a non-Indian school district located off the res. These little pinkish-colored areas, those are oil and gas fields. So guess where all the valuation goes at Wind River? The non-Indian school districts, right? Guess who drew up the boundaries? The Fremont County Boundary Board, right? So, you know, this is, we've got to change these kind of pictures, guys and gals. You know, the counties, and I had another little slide here that, you know, we're talking about the total valuation on, in this is a mill levy sheet from Fremont County. And all tribal leaders got to start understanding this. But this is how much taxes is collected. It's probably kind of hard to read back that way. But here's School District 14, School District 21, School District 38. It's a little bit further down here. But man. But anyway, the other thing I wanted to show was this other slide that kind of shows some of the valuation. See, this is the cities and towns, and again, you can see School District 14, see, their valuation is like $7 million. School District 21, $21 million. School District 38, $4 million, right? And look at the evaluations of some of these other districts. And then, like, remember when we talked about School District Number 2, which is off the res? See there, the valuation of the town itself is $2 million, but on the levy sheet over here, their valuation is what? $64 million. So guess where that other $62 million is coming from, right? Our oil and gas field. So these are things tribal leaders start having to understand, especially us energy producing tribes. So here's that lot of those numbers that are on that valuation sheet. The total value for the county is $1 billion. School District 14 gets $7 million. School District 21, 29, for a total of $41 million. The percent of valuation going to the Indian School District out of this, 0.41. Not even 1%, right? So anyway, and you know, a lot of what all the speakers talked about this morning, you're all right on. This is what we're being attacked. There's the dark side of federal Indian law. There's, you know, it's the states and counties. We're playing their game. So it's an important part. I probably got way less than 10 minutes now, but. You know, under the FOGRMA, BIA has a surface responsibility, and I don't even think they know that. BLM has a subsurface at Wind River. We're dealing with some very serious fracking issues. We've got some very serious issues regarding surface discharge from all the oil and gas fields. MMS does the production and accounting. Hydraulic fracturing, and then fracking is exempt from the Safe Drinking Water Act, right, under the Halliburton Amendment. The good thing about environment, tribes can adopt higher standards. And I'm sure Walter will agree with me. That's one of the few areas the Supreme Court has kind of upheld tribal sovereignties in the environmental side. And the good thing about EPA is they have an Indian policy that they adopted back in 83 or somewhere back in there. I wish BIA had an Indian policy. the real important part of this too is what's going on right here. You know, you students and you kids in college, we need that technical administrative presence. We need to attack these issues. We need that presence. We need a strong presence. Again, on land, the three estates are the surface, the mineral, and the water. You know, the BIA system evaluation and appraisal is prehistoric. and their realty and land records are pre-prehistoric. And so tribes got to contract all these functions. We've got to adopt all these laws, all these, you know, kind of codes, land use, rights of way, probate, property, zoning, severance, conservation, business. Conservation taxes. I think that's a good way to fund energy departments, get some of that technical presence. You know, there's 56 million acres of trust land in this country. You know, with that kind of a land base, we should be a pretty powerful force, right? If T. Boone Pickens had 56 million acres of land, he'd control the world, right? But that's part of kind of where we don't have that technical administrative presence. Land use planning, you know, looking at all of the resources that we have and doing it good. We had a good start of a land use code at Wind River, our plan. We just need to update that and get the good technical presence. You know, tribe-to-tribe commerce and regulatory structures to increase economies and sovereignty. You know, you really got to portray the tribal presence as an asset, but most people, especially out west, they don't see it like that. You know, we're a bother. And right now, we're the biggest taxpayer in Fremont County. And those non-Indians in Land and Riverton have a nerve to say, well, you Indians don't pay taxes. We're the biggest taxpayers in Fremont County. And now with our casinos and our economy moving, we're the largest employer probably in the state. And so with that unique legal and political presence we have as tribes, nobody can do some of the things that tribes can do. Water storage. That's got to be the main thing tribes got to look at. You know, those kind of things. So I think portraying a tribal presence as an asset. You know, these three resources can generate revenue, create jobs, and diversify our economies. Water, energy, and land. That's got to be our tribal mantra. When all of you leave this room, I want you all saying that. Water, energy, land. Alternative forms of energy are very important for many tribes. Recognition of tribal and Alati property rights, right? That's what Cobell was all about. Uphold the government-to-government relationship with the United States. Tribal leaders must take steps to exercise tribal sovereignty wisely through the adoption of codes, business codes, tax codes to create a climate conducive to economic development. Assessing our physical and governmental infrastructure. And a lot of people use infrastructure, that term, pretty loosely. But physical infrastructure, transportation, communication, power, solid waste, water, housing, fire protection. Tribes got to understand, what do we need? What do we have? Governmental infrastructure, what kind of laws and codes do we have? What kind of laws and codes do we need? Tribal court system, we're pretty lucky at Wind River. Technical administrative capabilities, organizational structure, financial integrity, enforcement authority. Progress being made, but like everybody's mentioned, we still got a lot of work to do, right? Tribal leaders must make the commitment to become knowledgeable statesmen and stateswomen, advisors who can be trusted and know the spiritual, cultural, and traditional connection we have to our surroundings, our homelands, and our Mother Earth. Younger tribal leaders do not understand the sovereignty battles that have occurred over the decades. Involve our youth. And all you youth that are here from Unity News Other, could I please ask you to stand real quick? All the youth that are here. Just stand. You don't have to make a speech. And I want you to, I'm going to tell you something here. And if Crawford was here, he would agree, and most of our traditional people here agree. You are the answer to our elders' prayers. You're the answer to our elders' prayers. And so we're thankful for you. Take care of yourself. And they always pray. When I hear those elders pray, what they say, we want our young people to be useful, respectful, and walk on a clear path. And that's what we want for you. Thank you. Give them a round, another round. Thank you. And the other group I'd like to recognize, all the veterans in the room, would you please stand? All the veterans, please stand. Let's give these guys applause too. Aho. Well, I had to skim through this real fast. Would like to spend more time. The referee here was showing me my time limits. But I'd be happy to take a few quick questions if there's any.
Just remarkable.
Thank you.
The tax situation was crazy.
Yeah, that's mind-blowing, you know. When most people see that, like, what's wrong with this picture, you know? Yeah, but, you know, that's the sad part of this, is that most people don't understand this. They don't understand the importance of having this type of information. And it is hard to understand. When we had to go meet with the county assessor so many times, she thought we were lonely, you know, because, what is this? You know, explain this meal levy sheet to me. You know? But it takes that time. And so we're now gearing up to establish a Wind River Tax Commission that's going to start working on all these issues for us. Every tribe's going to have a tax commission, too, you know. But sad to say, most tribal leaders don't understand this. And I think they're ready to, there's a lot of young, good tribal leaders, bless their hearts. They've got degrees and finance and, you know, master's degrees and, you know, good attorneys, but they just haven't been there, done that yet, you know. And just like Walter was saying, you know, I'm sure anxious to share my knowledge and my experience. I don't claim to know everything, but I did a little homework on some of this stuff, and sure want to help others understand how important that is to our tribes. And, you know, we've got a lot, you know, these young people that are here, we've got everywhere good, young, energetic, smart Indian, young Indian people. And I want you guys to be gearing up, run for the council one of these days, you know. So, again, thank you for your attention.